Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
I have you loud and clear.
Hello.
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 Welcome.
Science.
And that is to say
physics,
medicine,
nature,
or
space,
time,
the brain,
life,
the universe.
Hello, this week we're answering your science questions, including why am I getting hairier as I get older, how long are we supposed to live for, and could solar panels actually work in the moonlight? Plus, we've also got the lowdown on the recent cyber attacks sweeping the world, what's been happening, and also how can you protect yourself? I'm Chris Smith, and this is The Naked Scientist.
The Naked Scientist podcast is powered by ukfast.co.uk.
Now, today we're joined in the studio by a panel of experts who are ready and raring to answer your science questions. So let's meet them. First up, Richard Hollingham. He's the presenter of the Space Boffins podcast. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Now, the last time I saw you, since the last time I saw you, you've been over to the US.
I have, that hence the suntan.
Oh,
hence
I thought you'd just been in the UV
parlour
again.
Beautiful complexion. Now, I'm making two documentaries for the BBC on the Voyager missions and the Cassini mission. For transmission sometime in the summer.
Because you tweeted a picture of yourself with this tiny little speck on this enormous satellite dish.
Ah, that was Australia. I was in Australia.
You've been there as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh, you have been all over the place. So what were you doing on the dish?
So that was the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia, which is just this phenomenal radio telescope. Iconic. It gave us the pictures from the first moon landing in 1969. And I happened to go on the day where they were maintaining it. So I got to stand in this huge bowl in Australia in the sunshine. And that's just made my year, made my decade, that.
So space questions for Richard Hollingham, who has got an unfeasibly good suntan. Also sitting next to Richard is Kate Feller. She's a biologist at Cambridge University, and you won this year's Cambridge FameLab regional final.
Yes, Kate. I did.
Because you appeared on the programme. We were so impressed we invited you to come back. You told us all about shrimps. Any more shrimpy or marine stories to impart?
So I'm really excited because I just built my first robot. It's very simple, but its whole goal is to poke mantis shrimp in the tummy so that they strike at me. So it's just a poking robot. It's just a thing called a linear actuator that just literally pokes them in the tummy, and then they get really angry and they strike at me, and then I could study their strike.
I'm not surprising. And what's this I hear about you having shrimps in your suitcase?
So I just mentioned that I'm headed to Spain tomorrow to pick up some new animals, and I have to bring them back, so I put them in my checked luggage.
So what do you tell the customs person? I have a penchant for seafood or something.
I have some legal paperwork that I present when asked.
Okay, thank you very much. So anything sort of marine science and biology, that should go to Kate, so get your thinking caps on. Next to Kate is Andrew Holding. He researches cancer, and he's a researcher at Downing College in Cambridge. Hello, Andy. Good to have you back, because you've been on the programme before. Just remind people what you do.
So, I started out as a chemist, and I sort of gravitated over time towards becoming a cancer biology researcher, and what I do is I look at the things that drive breast cancer. So I'm trying to take apart all the pieces of the machine that drive it and try and find out which ones maybe we can target for a future therapy.
When you say things that drive it, you mean in a cell, why a cell becomes cancerous?
So in 70% of cases of breast cancer, it is driven by the estrogen receptor, and that goes onto the genes on the chromatin, on the DNA, and that then starts those genes to be active. And when it does that, it brings a load of other proteins with it. And what I'm trying to do is work out what are the other proteins and what do they do?
Because there might be potentially a druggable target in
there.
Something we can do. Thank you, Andy. And Jess Wade is also with us. She's a physicist, and she's from Imperial College in London. And you're a Lego person as well. You like Lego?
Yeah, I do like Lego. I got asked to go and talk at Lego Education this week in Denmark, and
I said I'd only go to Denmark. It's not Australia and it's not America. I said I'd only go if I got to go around kind Legoland. Of the big Lego house. Yeah. So we got to go and see the house where Lego lives, where the kind of Lego Ideas Lab is, and where they have all this fun kind of creating the new Lego for the future, and through a really sweet little Lego museum, and kind of see the history of Lego too, which was super fun. So yes, I'm a physicist, but I have an awful lot of fun doing it.
And what are they creating for the Lego of tomorrow? Did you get any sneaky previews?
So they're trying to change it from Lego being something where we build structures. So Lego tells us what to build. You see a picture of a car, you see a picture of a boat, and you do it. And they're trying to change it to something where you build with Lego. So Lego becomes more functional. So you can make your robot to poke your shrimps with out of your Lego rather than having to buy new pieces of plastic.
There you go, Kate.
Yeah.
Sorted. She's with Lego.
They would love it.
Now, Richard, this question from Paul, I think it's probably best coming your way.
I know there have been many missions to the moon, and it's incredible to think that humans have walked on its surface, but apart from because we can, what's the point? What are we actually going to learn?
Okay, so there are, I would say, three reasons. Reason one is resources. So you could look for helium-3. We could use that on Earth to power fusion reactors. You could maybe look for rare Earth elements on the moon. But actually, bringing stuff back from the moon is going to be a huge amount of energy, probably not worthwhile. You could use the moon's resources, so water, the rock there, to build bases or even to power future spacecraft, but that's slightly self-serving. So I would say the main point of going to the moon is because it's the next thing. It's the over the hill, it's across the river, it's over the sea. It's what we do as humans. It's aspirational. And then you could look for all the other reasons, that all the spin-offs we've got from space, like the computers, electronics, microwaves, the
Wi-Fi,
imaging technology, Wi-Fi, all these sort,
Velcro,
all these sorts of things.
Biros.
Well, yeah.
Is that true?
No, the Velcro's sort
smoke
of
detectors.
Not so true.
Smoke detectors, really?
Yep, and carbon monoxide detectors.
Oh, were they invented solely for the purpose of space?
Yes.
Can I throw one more thing in? It's inspiration. The people inspired by space, the kids inspired by space. You look at the two of the biggest entrepreneurs doing space right now, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, both inspired by the moon landings. They are the reasons to go to the moon.
Thank you very much, Richard. Now, Jess, we have to come back down to Earth with a bump for you.
Hello, Naked Scientists. My name's Karen, calling from Hollywood, California, and I got a pretty stinky question for you. How would you best remove flatulence from an automobile by opening a combination of windows and sunroof? Hey, thanks for your help. Take care.
I thought, Bet Jess, never in your whole career did you think that you would be coming to reach this moment to apply the rules of physics and fluid dynamics to ventilate a car.
Especially to be asked from California. I think that's brilliant. So there's obviously a few different issues here about how you get a fart out of a car. And one of them is about which windows you choose to open. The other one is what kind of temperature the fart is at, as disgusting as that sounds, because that affects how quickly it expands when it comes out into the atmosphere. And then the other one is which kind of gases are in the air already. So when the fart occurs, it comes out, it expands, it moves forward to the kind of front of the car, because that's a region of lower pressure if you're moving along, because the higher pressure region is at the back.
Why is that?
Because the air is accelerating forward, so it's pushing backwards, increasing the pressure at the back.
You're assuming the car is getting faster.
I'm assuming here that
the
car is moving
forward.
So
therefore the air is being
forward.
Left behind a bit
exactly.
Inside the car. So the fart's going to make its way towards the front.
Towards
so the driver
the front
is going to experience it more than the back
exactly.
Seat.
Well, that's just made me realise the worst thing you can do when someone farts in the car is try and accelerate away from it.
Yeah, so you should put the brakes on. Is that what you're saying?
It is, Jess? The worst thing you can do. And if you're in the passenger seat and you're the one who's done the fart, it's going to be very obvious very quickly, because it's going to go forward to the driver. And if you try and open the windows, which is what you'd probably try and do, there's interesting things that happen with kind of fluid flow. And you'd think if you were this little air particle in the car, you'd want to rush out, right? As soon as you get outside, you realize very quickly that the air there is not actually at the lower pressure that you assumed it was at, and it's much lower pressure inside the car. So the air there isn't moving with you. It's outside. So you rush back into the car. So the smell doesn't leave if you just open one of the windows, which
right.
I think
you
is super interesting.
More than one window, then.
So I think to get this fart out, Karen in California, you have to slightly open the front window and open the back window so that you create a kind of flow through the car. This really interesting, you can get really interesting graphics of it, of kind of turbulent flow going through these two open windows.
Right now, actually.
And then, I'm not going to make any judgment here. You could also get smart materials to make your car seats out of that actually absorb odours. So smart materials are materials that have a function when you do something to them. So materials like ones that you can jump up and down on and then they produce electricity, kind of piezoelectric materials. But you can also get clever ones that can trap the smells. So smells are usually kind of carbon-based molecules, and you can get ones that get trapped in the fabric so you don't smell those at all. So that is one option. But the other option is obviously also doing this with the windows.
Okay, so a front window open a bit, a back window open a bit, yeah. And that should achieve the right pressure differential to vent the fart.
Entirely right.
Jess, fartologist, thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Imperial.
Yeah.
That training.
Now, Andrew, on that sort of appetite intestinal note, listener Liam is wondering, why do we lose our appetite? Probably like half our listenership have lost their appetite when we see or hear gross things. What do you think?
So this is a fascinating one. So as we're discussing, if you get a foul smell or you see something that's particularly gross, it's really, really hard to then go and have a burger straight afterwards. It's just our bodies reject food. And there's quite a lot of sense to that. It's pretty much a learned reaction that if something you've seen before has made you ill, you will eventually build up a response to it. It means you won't eat it again. And this is the same sort of idea as Pavlov's dogs, which hopefully many people have heard of, which is this guy who kept ringing a bell for his dogs and giving them food at the same time. And eventually, when he rang the bell, they were still salivating as if the food was coming when it wasn't. But my favourite fact about these learnt responses is that there was another person around who's called Skinner, and he was working on pigeons. And the reason you haven't heard much about him is he was involved in the US's pigeon-guided missile effort. Now, do you know about this, Chris?
No, I don't. Tell me.
What they realised is you could train a pigeon to peck on an image of a target. And the idea was, if you put the pigeon in the missile and it could see where it was going, it would peck where the target was and guide the missile to where it was heading.
So there were sort of birdseed factories all over the place that were really worried as soon as this starts to happen, because they think they could suddenly get an unexpected visit from a missile.
But as you can tell by the fact, these missiles are so popular now, but this was never a successful program. But if you go through the history, you find that this was tried several times, that people thought this was a great idea.
Well, actually, there was a paper that came out a couple of years ago. It's a gentleman I spoke to from California, and he's actually turned pigeons into pathologists, because he was asking pigeons to look at and review images of cancers. And he had sort of, you've heard of crowdsourcing, where he was doing what he called flock sourcing. So you have a big group of pigeons and you train them and reward them when they peck at a picture when it's got cancer in the picture of the cells that a pathologist would look at under a microscope. And the pigeons very quickly became much better at this than a whole group of trained pathologists. The reason is that they're just very, very visually good, because they have extremely good eyesight, birds do. And when you're just looking for pattern recognition, what a cancer looks like, you know, why does it have to be a pathologist? You have a pigeon to do that, and they quickly screen things out, and then you just focus your pathologist on the stuff that matters. But back to Liam's point then, what gross things grossing us out and suppressing your appetite, you're saying it's just a learned response. You experience something horrible, it makes you throw up, so the next time that something horrible like that comes along, you avoid it.
Yeah. I mean, there are some things that may be more or less ingrained in you, like bitter tastes. Obviously, young children really don't like bitter things, so they don't eat bitter berries.
Okay.
How would you account for kind of almost innate revulsion for smelling poop?
Well, some people are fine with poop and some people aren't.
I'm not.
You're not.
No, but I've had children. I know. I'm definitely not.
And you can definitely train yourself against it by the fact that, you know, you can deal with your kids' nappies. The first time it's pretty shocking. After 3 years of it, you're fed up with it.
After 3 years of it, you're ready to go nappy negative.
There's a reason chicks get potty trained.
Yes, there certainly is. Now, Kate, question for you. Rachel has got in touch and she wants to know if there are any invisibility cloaks in the animal kingdom. In other words, could an animal render itself invisible?
So to be invisible means that basically that your body contrast is diminished relative to the background. So it's like when any kind of soldier wears camouflage that makes them blend into the forest behind them. So that is a type of invisibility cloak. But there's animals that are much better than military folk. In particular, a lot of the cephalopods, like octopus, squid, and cuttlefish in particular, have this really dynamic patterning on their skin that is electrically controlled. And so they can match their background almost instantaneously. It's fantastic.
And it's a myth that that chameleons blend into their background. It's not true. They do it more for communication, not for camouflage. Is that true?
I've never worked with a chameleon. I do know that their skin changes color, but it's very, very slow. And if they are camouflaged, it's probably because they just have a pattern on their skin that makes them more camouflaged, regardless of what color they change. There's also animals that are completely transparent. They live in the open ocean, and they have no pigments in their tissue, and they also have special adaptations in their muscles so that light, when it enters their tissue, doesn't scatter like it would in milk and or in like a cloudy piece of glass. And so they are just totally invisible, unless they have eyes, because eyes can't be totally invisible, otherwise they don't work.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Naked Scientist with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, we'll be joined by cybersecurity expert Paul Harris to get to grips with the recent cyber attack that spanned 150 countries. We'll find out what's actually happened, where that malware came from, and what we can do about it. And also, if you have any questions for a future Q&A show like this, you can send them in by emailing chris@thenakedscientist.com. Now, a few weeks ago here on The Naked Scientist, we actually reported on the discovery that the caterpillar of the wax moth can eat plastic bags. And remarkably, this was found out completely by accident, because one of the researchers on the paper that was published in Current Biology, and she keeps bees as a hobby, found some of these larvae in her beehive where they're a pest. And she put them in a plastic bag, thinking she would study them later, went back to the bag later to get the caterpillars so she could look at them, and they'd all gone because they'd eaten their way out of the bag. So we thought it'd be quite fun to ask if you, as a team, have come across any particular scientific discoveries made entirely by accident. Jess, anything you've come across?
Yeah, so I have a few, actually. There's so many accidents in physics that make kind of magical things happen, one of which is post-it notes. Scientists who are trying to make glue were obsessed with making the world's strongest glue. And someone called Spencer Silver was trying to make this really, really strong glue, and he was systematically failing, which is great, by the way, in science. And what he did was accidentally make a glue that was really, really rubbish. And he put it on some paper and then found the paper just came off everything he was putting it on. He was really frustrated. But actually, that's incredibly useful when it comes to something like a post-it note, where you just want to put it on a page and then take it off and not damage the page. So he didn't quite realize the kind of empire he'd created at this time. And I think that's just really brilliant. You try and do one thing and you make something that's actually much more valuable.
Richard, I'm working on the Voyager, documentary on the Voyager missions at the moment. And most space missions, you get unexpected discoveries. You point a telescope at something, you find all sorts of cool stuff. Voyager 1 in 1979, so it'd been in space 2 years by this point, and it was about to head off beyond the solar system. So it was in orbit around Jupiter. And it wasn't in orbit around it, it was just passing through Jupiter, past Jupiter. And it needed to find its direction out of the solar system. So it was using the moon Io to look and just get its position. And they sent the image back, and they looked at this image. It was all blurry at the top. So they thought, well, what's going on with the camera? Maybe the camera's broken. And they took another image, and they discovered that was a volcano. So they found the first active volcanoes other than on Earth on this moon of Jupiter. And now we know there are around about 400 active volcanoes on the moon Io.
Okay.
So there's actually a paper that came out that was based off of this guy's accidental discovery. He's a dragonfly biologist, and he was at a pond waiting for female dragonflies who had just mated so that he could collect their eggs. And he observed this female was being pursued by a male and then just dropped out of the sky and just crash-landed in the grass. And he thought that she had crashed and died, and she was like on her back in very unnatural, dead-like position, and the male came over and was like, oh, you're dead, that's too bad, and flew away.
How's it go again?
Well, I'm really disappointed. and so then the researcher went over to look at this female dragonfly, and she just, like a lightning, just took off. And so he then was like, whoa, did she just fake her own death so she didn't have to mate? And he did a proper study and found that, yes.
Are you saying this is the dragonfly equivalent of not tonight, I've got a headache?
Yeah, except if instead of actually articulating something, you just played dead. Like you just were in the pub and some guy was picking on you and you just collapsed to the floor and people called the ambulance.
Does this happen to you much, Kate?
I know I'm married, so I don't have that issue.
Right. This question, Jess, is from Mike, and he's got an unusual idea for a possible renewable energy source.
How much energy is in moonlight, and could solar panel technology be used to capture this energy?
So, solar-powered nightlights.
I think
feasible?
This is an interesting question, especially leading on from the moon-related chat earlier. I think, so for a solar panel to work at all, you need a material called a semiconductor. And a semiconductor is kind of halfway between a metal, which conducts all the time, and an insulator, which is like a plastic that doesn't conduct. And in a semiconductor, you have this gap between it not conducting and it conducting. And what you need to do is you need to have enough energy to get the little electrons in that not conducting part to the conducting part. And when you've put that energy in from the sunlight, then it can start working and generate power. And if you had a semiconductor that was the right thing for sunlight, obviously, if you got enough light intensity from the moon reflected back, you could have this kind of moon solar panel. But the moon's not very reflective. It's about 3% of the sun's light. So we're not getting a lot of it back like that. So we'd have to have a really efficient concentrator to concentrate all that light coming back from the moon. And actually, you can find it. I think a group in Spain made this really beautiful kind of glass orb that you can generate power from the moon's light. The other option is to put solar panels on the moon and then send the energy back as microwaves.
Richard?
Well, I was going to suggest maybe a mirror in space. I know the Soviet Union were very keen on this back in the 1970s. I think they did some, or at least planned some experiments. You had the planes, you could light them at night from sunlight with mirrors in space.
I think entirely that this kind of thing is dreamy blue skies research ideas, that either you put solar panels on the moon or you put mirrors in space and shine the light back. Because obviously the moon has no atmosphere, and all these other things that we lose so much of the light intensity coming to Earth wouldn't happen up there. It's incredibly expensive, and we should probably channel more money into researching, and I'm pretty sure we're great at it now, researching renewables on Earth before we start playing around in the skies.
There was some idea about having a giant microwave beam that would gather energy in space and then send that energy down as a huge microwave beam and collect it with a dish on Earth. Obviously, there are losses at all these all the stages, but was there not some concern that if an aeroplane or something inadvertently flew through the microwave beam, it would be cooked out of existence?
Well, it does seem an extraordinary idea. I think the big issue with solar energy is storage. It's the big issue with renewable energy generally, and that's the thing, isn't it, Jess, needs to be sorted.
We've got pretty good at storage now. Lithium-ion batteries are a really good way to store it, and we're getting really, really good at that research and really good at it in this country. There's loads of great research groups doing it. So I don't think it's storage. Genuinely, I think it's political, the reasons that we haven't taken it up yet, but also obviously the cost of doing any kind of extraterrestrial renewable energy research is a bit out of our range at the moment.
Kate?
Oh, I just had one other point about the moon being used for a solar panel. Just the fact that it has phases, and it also, like, the light doesn't decrease linearly as it goes from full to half phase to new moon, that it actually, by half phase, it's only one-fifth of the already 3% that you have.
So once a month you've got no light at all.
Once a month we're winning, and the rest of the time it's just like
not so good. Now, Richard, Sam has been in touch, and he wants to ask about muscles in space. Now, these are muscles as in your muscles, your biceps, not muscles that you get from the sea and like study like Kate does. Now, he says they can waste in space because of decreased gravity. Does that mean that astronauts return to Earth really weak? And so are they up there on the International Space Station weightlifting every day?
Yes. There we go. Space is really bad for you. So because there's no gravity, you do get muscle loss. So astronauts have to exercise 2 hours a day. 2 hours a day, every day of the week. And even then, they return to Earth with weakened muscles. More seriously, there's a loss in bone density as well, which is useful for studying astronauts in space because that might be applied to osteoporosis or other diseases on Earth. Other things that astronauts experience, lack of sleep. That's partly because you've got daylight every 90 minutes or so. Eyesight gets worse. They don't entirely know why that is yet. You've got the radiation risk, so increased risk of cancer. You get zapped by cosmic rays all the time. There's even weakened immune system. Again, they don't know the entire reason for that. It's bad. Space is bad. Scott Kelly spent a year in space, and they reckon he's going to take another year to recover fully. Peggy Whitson, currently up on the space station, she's now holds the record for 560 days in space. But these are all super fit people when they go up. But it does take a while to get back. My favourite quote on this is from Bones in Star Trek, from the first of the new Star Trek movies. Space is disease and danger wrapped in darkness and silence.
It's good to see Star Trek quoted on the programme. Jess?
does anything good happen? So there was that story about Scott Kelly. Do you not get taller when you come back from space?
Oh, yes, you do. Yeah, you do. But that in itself is a problem because you're fitted for your spacesuit. So they get in the... now they only have the Soyuz capsule. So fitting their spacesuit to go up and actually getting back, they're taller.
It's sort of really... You in.
They literally squeeze them in to the... So they have to make the seat slightly bigger. So when they come back, they will fit in the seat.
They're recycling the suits all the time anyway, right? They don't make the suit just
for
you.
No, they do make the suit just for you. So you do have your own spacesuit. So you're fitted. They have these special suit checks and everything. So, yeah.
And they're incredibly expensive too, those suits, aren't they?
Yeah, weirdly, they're still laced up. I mean, they're basically the same spacesuit, more or less, that Yuri Gagarin flew in. So they are extraordinary. They're very old technology. They're laced up and they're kind of wrapped in on themselves.
Okay.
How does skin react to being in space? Like, do astronauts have to moisturize all the time, or are they actually holding their moisture much better in space?
Yeah, that's interesting. I would imagine it's an issue because it's not so much that they're in space, it's that they're in this rather nasty air-conditioned environment.
Now, Andrew, let me put this age-old, or I suppose I should say old-age question your way.
Hi, Naked Scientists. I'm Stefan, calling from Sweden. So I'm getting older and, for example, my eyesight is deteriorating, which I find understandable. But why do other parts of the body speed up? Why are my ears growing hair like never before?
So why has Stefan got hairy ears as he gets older, Andrew?
Well, this is a problem many of us face, sadly. And that's as we get older, certain parts of our body start growing more hair and certain other parts start growing less hair. And this is for several reasons, but you may notice that it's generally men who suffer from this. I don't know about you, Chris, do you?
Well, I have noticed that actually the hairs in my nose seem to grow longer as I've got older. I haven't noticed them being more numerous, but I've certainly noticed that they seem to get longer before they fall out.
So the maybe good thing for you about that is that says that you've got lots of testosterone because that's what's causing these to grow. So the hairs in your nose basically go through three different phases. And the phase which makes them grow longer, that phase is caused by the amount of testosterone you have. So as you get older and as that testosterone has more of an effect because you've just had it for longer, that phase seems to gradually get bigger and bigger. And it's also why women are generally protected from this.
So a person who, like Stefan, says they're getting hairier as they're getting older, it's because the testosterone that they're being exposed to is making hairs on the body grow relatively for longer before they fall out. So it's not that you're becoming hairier, it's that more hairs grow for longer, so you notice them more.
Yeah, and your eyebrows also grow longer, and you get to that fateful moment where the hairdresser says, do I need to trim your eyebrows?
Hasn't happened to me yet.
I'm fingers crossed.
You're listening to The Naked Scientist. I'm Chris Smith. Now, before we go to any more questions, though, we've got a little quiz. Okay, so it's quiz time, everybody. So rather than people sending in the questions, I've got some questions for you. And we're going to have two teams. Rich and Kate are going to be team one. Andrew and Jess, you're going to be team two. Now, the rules are really simple. We've got three questions each. I'll ask you something. Give me the answer and you'll either get one of these. Or you get one of these. If you get it wrong. Let's start with Richard and Kate. So question one, what's heavier, a proton or a neutron, or same? What do you think, you two?
Oh.
Oh, my. It's been...
Not very much, either
high
of them. I know, that's the trouble, isn't
they're,
it?
They're similar in size, it's the electrons that are super tiny.
Yeah.
Well,
I would go with...
Proton.
Proton, yeah.
So you're going for proton is heavier?
Yeah.
No, I'm sad to say, at 1.674 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, neutrons are slightly heavier than protons, which weigh a weighty 1.672 times 10 to the minus 27 kilos, but they're both considerably more massive than an electron. You're right on that score. An electron weighs about 2,000 times less than that. Mm. Right, over to the other team. Let's see if you can beat them. Wouldn't be hard, would it? You just have to get one right. Okay. Would the hydrogen-rich gas giant planet Jupiter, in theory, float or sink if you were to put it into water? So assuming you had a planet-sized ocean you could bob Jupiter into, drop it in, would it float or would it sink? What do you think?
So by the centre, it's going to be getting pretty dense. But yeah. It's pretty big. So I think the outside, if you average across the whole thing, it's going to be lighter than water because water's really dense.
Yeah, I mean... I have literally no way in my mind of imagining this happening. But I imagine if you can similarly displace enough water with your massive dense core, then it would float, right?
You're going for Jupiter would float?
Yeah.
Okay. A team spirit here. Okay, well, according to NASA, Jupiter's density is 1.326 grams per centimetre cubed, and that means Jupiter is denser than water, which has a density of 1, and so therefore Jupiter would sink, not float. Okay, back to Richard and Kate. Here we go. Strung end to end, all of the DNA molecules in your body's cells would stretch to Pluto and back about 5 times. What do you think?
Whoa.
That's a long way.
That is a long way. Pluto and back 5 times. All the DNA.
All of the DNA. So all the DNA from all
this
of
could
our
be one of those. This is going to be one of those trick questions. It's going to be like 6 times, isn't it? Or 4 times or something like that.
If it was in the context of how many times around the planet, I would feel more comfortable with that analogy.
Well, I was going to go for false.
False, yeah.
Yeah.
You're going false?
Yeah.
Oh! Actually, it's quite interesting, this one. So the DNA in each of your about 40 trillion or so cells, it's about 2 meters long. So if you stretch it all out end to end, it would form a strand that's roughly 80 trillion meters, and that's 80 billion kilometers in length. Now, the distance to Pluto is about 7.5 billion kilometers, so you should actually have enough DNA in there to get there and back about 5 times. Which is really quite extraordinary. So it's a level pegging on high score. Nought.
Your panel of
experts. Right, okay, here we go. So it's Andy and Jess's go now. So which, in theory, is the more poisonous, a crane fly or daddy long legs or a puffer fish? Which has the worst venom, do you think, you two?
Okay.
See, I've heard about the crane fly, and I've also heard that it can't penetrate your skin.
But I only said which is, in theory, the most poisonous.
So I reckon it's definitely not going to be a puffer fish. It's similar to your...
But I think this is one of these big urban myths that actually they're not even that poisonous if they did bite you.
Wait, what, a pufferfish?
The crane fly.
Okay.
A pufferfish is the one that...
Like, I rarely think about crane flies.
I haven't ever...
You always think about
crane flies. Pufferfish, that's one they make fugu from, right?
Yeah.
So that does kill you.
That does kill you entirely. I remember that from The Simpsons. You can't get much more. As long as we're...
Gonna push you.
So, okay, let's go... What, are we,
you can't get more
should we go completely
dead.
Rogue?
Are
and
you going pufferfish or are you going daddy long legs?
Ooh.
Make your choice.
Pufferfish, fine.
Pufferfish.
Thank you.
They scored. Finally, they're off the bottom. Crane flies aren't poisonous at all. That's a complete myth. According to Toxipedia, the lethal dose of pufferfish venom, which is a chemical called tetrodotoxin, is 334 micrograms per kilogram of body weight in a mammal like a mouse. So there really is absolutely no contest. Steer clear of tetrodotoxin if you go and eat pufferfish, which otherwise known as fugu, in the restaurant. Make sure a good chef prepares it for you. Right, you guys, back to Richard and Kate. Here we go. The average person walks a distance equivalent to about 10 laps of the Earth in their lifetime.
Ooh. This is like the Pluto one again,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I would have got the
except
Saturn
it's
one
on Earth.
Or the Jupiter one right. Oh,
I mean, is this the average person on the planet, or is this the average person from the UK?
The average American.
The US? Mm. I mean, very different between the US and America.
Yeah.
Average person,
can
it says
that
here.
Really be true?
Let's go for it. We didn't before.
Should we just go?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll just go for true.
Let's do it.
True. Yeah.
No!
Oh! If only The Simpsons could have helped us with that, because I knew about pufferfish from The Simpsons as well. Yeah.
No, the average person walks about 7,500 steps a day. So in an 80-year lifetime, that's about 220 million steps. So average stride length being what it is, every 2,200 steps, that's about a mile. So the average person walks about 100,000 miles in their lifetime. Distance around the equator, 25,000 miles, 24,000 miles. So a person walks the equivalent of about 4 or 5 laps of the Earth in their lifetime. So there you go. So we do have a winner, but would you like to have your final question, just to really trounce them, you two? Would you like that?
Yeah,
or are you happy to let them off? Right, okay, well, relative to their body weight, which is the stronger, an Asian elephant or an Asian weaver ant?
Oh, I bet it's the ant.
It must be, mustn't it? I've never seen an elephant, like, pick up something 10 times its size.
Yeah, let's go for the ant.
Okay, convincing win from team Andrew and team Jess. In terms of body weight, the ant wins. In 2010, Cambridge zoologist Thomas Endline photographed an Asian weaver ant holding a 500 milligram weight in its jaws, and that's about 100 times its body weight. In terms of tonnage, though, it's the elephant that's the hand down or trunk down winner. According to the Food and Agriculture Association of the UN, elephants used in Sri Lanka's logging industry commonly pull around 3 or 4 tons at a time in a day. Wikipedia tells us that Asian elephants also tend to weigh about as much as this anyway, so the ant wins. So we don't need the tiebreaker. Well done, Andrew and Jess. Right, Richard, here's one for you. It's from Hannah.
In a space mission, Which is actually more dangerous, taking off from Earth or landing back on Earth safely?
Actually, if you look at the statistics on this, during launch, only one crew has died. So that was the Challenger disaster in 1986, where seven died. With the Soyuz, which is the Russian spacecraft, in 1983, two crew were ejected on the escape system. So seven people have died on launch, but still seven people too many. If you look at landings, I think they're more dangerous. So you look at the first Soyuz capsule, the cosmonaut died because his parachute became tangled. The Columbia disaster in 2003, where seven crew died on the way back to Earth. And then in 1971, three crew died on Soyuz 11. So we've had 11 astronauts die re-entering the atmosphere. And if you think about that, actually it makes a lot of sense, because escape systems are normally built into spacecraft. One of the big flaws of the space shuttle, it didn't have an escape system. So the first space shuttle that flew into space had ejector seats, but after that there was no provision to get the crew out if something went wrong, whereas the Soyuz has that. So if something goes wrong on the launch pad, the rocket blows up, the escape system will eject, and it's proved that works. The same with the previous American missions as well. But you look at the return to Earth, well, there's so much that could go wrong. The parachute getting tangled, a faulty component, or there could have been damage. So with the Space Shuttle Columbia, there was damage during launch to the spacecraft, which meant it burnt up on the way down. But both are really dangerous.
Kate?
You mentioned kind of the worst case scenario, people dying, but how about just getting injured?
Well, it's interesting with the Soyuz, because I've interviewed a few astronauts about this. It's been variously described as going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, or going over Niagara Falls in a barrel on fire, followed by a car crash, because it is pretty awful. And there have almost certainly been some broken limbs and damage done in the Soyuz coming back to Earth. But almost everyone has walked away from a spacecraft.
I was in Perth in Western Australia week before last with Steve Robinson, who's been an astronaut on a number of shuttle missions and done a number of spacewalks. And he showed me a picture of what your ambulance is like if you need an emergency trip home, and told me what the G-forces are like. And to say that a roller coaster ride is exhilarating would be, you know, really quite an understatement, because, you know, thinking you've got someone who's unwell, injured in some way, and then gets this like 6G, 7G ride back home to Earth and then crash lands down with a bump, it sounds horrendous.
Yeah, 230 metres per second is the speed. Yeah, because, I mean, on the space station, if you just look at the medicine on the space station, you've basically got about the same degree of medical help on the space station as you would decide a public swimming pool. That sort of degree of first aid.
There,
no. If you get really sick up there, you get bundled into a Soyuz and sent back to Earth.
Thank you, Richard. Jess, Mike would like you to answer this one for him.
What actually makes a waterproof coat waterproof?
I think this is a really nice question, because it's another one of the kind of accidental discovery ones. It's made out of a polymer. So a polymer is a long chain of atoms all connected together, or long chain of carbon atoms. And it's actually, again, similar to the stuff that I research, but I research conjugated polymers. So there you have single double bonds between these carbons. And this is a polymer called PTFE, which is polytetrafluoroethylene. I had to look at that to make sure I said it all right. I am not a chemist, but I hang out with a lot of them. And a guy called Robert Gore, as in Gore-Tex, was playing around with PTFE, trying to pull apart rods of it to create a really, really long thread of it. And what they were trying to do was pull apart these rods at really, really high temperatures, really slowly, to kind of eke it out into this really, really long string to make things that would be really, really sturdy, resistant fibers and stuff like that. And what he realized after a long time of playing with this was that if he pulled it apart incredibly quickly, rather than doing it slowly at all, he got this really poor structure. So he generated this structure that had loads and loads of tiny, tiny little holes inside it. And that only happened if he did it really, really quickly. So it increased it by about 800 times its own size, and he created something that was about 70% air. And this structure is actually really neat for making clothes out of, because it doesn't let water get through. So water drops that you get on the surface, like if you're outside in the rain on a mountain, don't get through, but you can let sweat out. So that's the kind of difference between a waterproof jacket, a jacket that you can wear out and wear it and sweat in, or something that's just water resistant, like something like PVC that you get really sweaty and you can't wear it for very long. And it's because of this porous structure, which I think is really neat. And it was a complete accident that he did that at all.
And the reason that the raindrops won't come through but the sweat does is the sweat's water vapour. So that's individual groups of molecules of water which can get through these tiny holes. But by the time they've formed a big droplet, that clings to itself very hard and won't break up into small enough particles to get back through the hole.
Exactly right. It's like a sieve, right? So when we have a sieve, the holes are exactly the right size to let this tiny little water vapour through, but not they're too small to let this massive water drop through.
John is with us on the phone. Hello, John.
Hello.
You've got a question for Richard. Fire away.
Yes. Yep. I'd like to know how you overcome the temperature on the surface of the moon in terms of being on there because of the plus temperature when you're in the light and the minus temperature when you're in the dark. And also, how do you overcome the space debris that's coming in constantly on the surface of the moon?
So range of questions there, Richard. So high temperature in the sun, low temperature in the shade, and possible impactors.
Yeah, even worse than that is all the cosmic radiation and everything else you're being bombarded with on the moon. So the astronauts that have already walked on the moon, so during the Apollo missions, they had, I mean, very sophisticated multi-layer spacesuits, and we would have them again. And you would need their visors. You see those pictures where it almost entirely reflects, and you see it outside the space station as well, this almost mirrored visor over the top. But you're not going to be outside for a huge amount of time, maybe a few hours at one time. It is a big issue if we're going to have a moon base. So what they're looking at is 3D printing a moon base from the lunar surface, so from the rocky, dusty surface itself. And I've seen the prototype for this in Cologne in the German space agency, and it is...
Haven't Lego got something to say about
this? It's a printer that goes bzz, 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 and it's printing these blocks, and it's not unlike Lego.
They have a lot of 3D printers.
You have this idea of you have these interlocking blocks you can make out of the lunar regolith, and you can build your shelter. And that's where you need to be most of the time. You cannot hang around outside on the moon for a long time.
Thanks, Richard. This is The Naked Scientist with me, Chris Smith. Now let's consider an event that's hit the headlines big time this year. The recent cyber attacks across 150 countries have affected hundreds of thousands of computers. And in the UK, the National Health Service has been among the organisations that has been impacted. Well, with us is cybersecurity expert Paul Harris. He's the managing director of the Manchester-based firm Sukarma. First of all, what is this threat that's brought computers to their knees across the world?
Well, the attack that happened on Friday the 12th of May was a ransomware attack. It was called WannaCry. Multiple strains of ransomware attacks are out there currently, and this was just one particular type that attacked certain versions of Windows software.
How did people's computers get infected?
So it was most likely triggered by a phishing email where people are encouraged to either click on a link or open an attachment, which then downloads malware. In the instance of WannaCry, the payload, as it's called, this ransomware software, then started to encrypt all of the files on the computer that it attacked. And that means they're effectively locked and you can't unlock them unless you get a decryption key. What this then went on to do, this particular attack, was then search for other devices and computers on the network and start to attack those. So it spread very quickly. And then once it had attacked all of those computers, it would then start pinging externally and look for other computers to attack.
And do we know where this threat came from?
No. I think when it started, like most ransomware attacks, the assumption was that it was an individual cyber criminal. Probably unlikely we'll ever find out for certain. There are some interesting theories, though, around whether this is actually a government attack. So if you think about countries in the world that are sort of posturing at the moment and putting on big displays of their military capabilities, the malware behind WannaCry was actually based on some malware that was out in the world earlier in the year in around January that was created by a hacking team in North Korea called the Lazarus Group.
Now, given that the people who are doing this are asking for a ransom, can we not just see where the money goes and then we go and catch them?
Unfortunately, Unfortunately not, no, because the cyber criminals' currency of choice is something called Bitcoin, which is a cryptocurrency. So what you can see is their wallet. So on the attack from Friday, there was about £60,000 put into this wallet. You don't know who has put money in and you can't see who takes money out. The reason that criminals like Bitcoin is because there is no central bank. So it's very, very difficult to trace who has them. Once you've got that money, like most criminals, what they do is then launder that through one or two sources to turn it into cash.
And once your computer has been locked, is there no way back without paying the ransom?
The advice is don't pay. It does pose quite a difficult question for you. If you're smart, you'll have kept backups, regular backups, and you'll have a system in place to ensure that you're able to reinstate. It's a bigger problem for businesses, but if a business is regularly taking backups and those backups are separated from the network, then you're much, much safer. If you haven't got that, then you are faced with a difficult choice, which is, do I pay? It's a relatively small amount of money, but at the end of the day, you're dealing with criminals, and there's nothing to say that someone won't come back next week and attack you if you've demonstrated that you're able to pay.
Andrew?
So my real concern is that I have to use lots of very old Windows computers for my work because they're attached to a piece of hardware which is worth £250,000, maybe more. We don't have the budget to replace the hardware, even if the computer's cheap to replace, and no one's going to write a driver for that hardware. So what can they actually do?
What Microsoft have done following this recent attack is they've gone back to software that had been obsoleted by them, so they were no longer supporting it, and they have gone back and created security patches to try and close these vulnerabilities down. But it's the way that software companies work. They will only support a piece of software for so long, and then they move on to their new product. You can protect yourself to a degree by all of the basics that we should be doing, running patches on our software, particularly critical security patches, running antivirus software, having firewalls, having strong passwords, not using the same password for everything that we do, which is, it's something that we all do because it's so much easier, but really don't. And have really good discipline about emails.
Kate?
Are these attackers able to get your data or information off of your computer, or is it just a lockdown?
Yes, everybody needs to step away from the idea that you can be safe online, because that's a dangerous concept. We don't expect our houses, for example, to be completely impenetrable. We accept there's a certain element of risk there, and it's the same online. So cyber criminals, whoever they are after multiple things. They're after your data. They're after credit card information. They want to try and get into your bank account. They're looking to steal company secrets, military secrets. We've all got things digitally that are valuable to us, and it is impossible to entirely protect them. It comes down to how valuable is it to you, and how much time and effort and budget are you prepared to spend protecting it. And you can make yourself safe from most of these types of attacks, but you'll never be 100% secure.
Is it fair enough to say as well, Paul, that sometimes some of these threats, the worst ones, are the ones you don't know about, because you could well have things lurking on your computer where the hacker has created for themselves access to your computer and all of your data that Kate's worried about, and you don't know that, and they can, when they want to, access your computer or call up your computer and use it to do their bidding from afar?
That's very true, and that's the majority of cyber attacks are stealthy. They don't want you to know they're there. A ransomware is a very noisy attack because you have to be alerted because they want you to pay, but by far the majority of attacks are stealthy. So yet you don't necessarily know, and they're not necessarily always after you. They might just be taking over your machines to help them attack other people.
And just to finish, Paul, what proportion do you think of people's computers probably do have malware on them? If you took an average person off the street, now I appreciate this is a hard question for you to answer, but plucking a number from the air with all of the risk attached there too, what proportion do you think?
I think if you think that last year 3.1 billion records were leaked, I think it's probably fair to assume that most of us have got our data on the dark web. It's been stolen at some point from either from us directly or from websites that we use, which is why it's really important to change that, the information that you have. And if you think in business terms, I've seen stats between 50 and sort of 75% of businesses in the UK reporting cyber attacks last year. So it's one in two or worse, your probability of being attacked.
That's very, very sobering, isn't it? Thank you very much, Paul Harris, who is the Managing Director of Manchester-based online security company Sakama. This is a question for you, Andrew, which is coming from John. How long are we actually supposed to live for as a species?
Well, thank you for that really cheery question. This is actually really interesting, though. So you can sort of take the very simple idea that your only job as a living creature is to have babies, and then they go on and have more babies. And if you take that approach, 30 is probably reaching a ripe old age, because by that time you've had several babies. The mortality rate for having children is quite high, certainly for women over men, and your job's done. That isn't actually what seems to have happened in humans. At some point, we suddenly realised it was actually quite useful to keep old people around to look after the kids when the fit people went off hunting. And so we've ended up where you find a point somewhere around Neanderthal to Homo sapiens where the life expectancy starts going up. And of course, we don't know whether the life expectancy goes up because of a social change or a physiological change, but we do know it suddenly became very advantageous to keep the old people around to look after your children.
Jess?
Is there something about the number of heartbeats that you have as a mammal? Do hummingbirds with crazy numbers of heartbeats a minute have something like a much shorter life?
The only thing I'm going to be careful about is hummingbirds aren't obviously a mammal.
Oh, yeah.
But
physicist.
if you look at mammals, like a hamster versus an elephant, you're absolutely right. And we are massively off that. It's like a line between length of life versus heartbeat rate. And humans are off it. They're completely away from the line.
The point that Jess is alluding to is if you have a higher metabolic rate because you are small, because a hamster or a mouse has to burn a lot of energy to stay warm because it's losing huge amounts of heat through this enormous body air relative to a tiny core. Whereas we're a bit bigger, so we don't have that constraint. But yet, if you look at how long we live, it's out of step with how long we should live. And so people are, you're saying, suggesting there must be some sociological reason to keep people in the population. Could it not just be, though, that the world we grew up in was just so awful, you know, when we evolved as a species, that we had to breed ourselves to be genetically super fit in order to compete with that environment, and it just means that that gives us this added longevity?
So where it gets complicated is the fact that you can't pass genes on after you have children. But in a way you can, because if your elder generation is helping, by proxy your offspring are going to survive longer, even though they're a generation delayed. And that's where it kind of gets interesting. It's because most animals don't do that. You don't see a multi-generation survival. And it also means that offspring of a different line survive. And that's when we get these really odd social effects, really pinch benefiting a species which you wouldn't otherwise expect to see.
And we don't see this, or do we see this, in other animals? If we look at whales, because they're very long-lived, and elephants as well, is there a similar sort of grandmother effect there?
We don't see this deviation from the heartbeats in anything other than humans, as far as I'm aware.
Even though there are these long-lived animals that live in a big group?
There's no evidence for it.
Fascinating. Andrew, thanks very much. Now, Jess, can you help her out with Lois and her husband? Because they have got an argument going on. They're saying, my standard way of opening a metal jar lid on a glass jar for the first time is to run hot water over the lid. I think the jar opens more easily because the lid expands with the heat, but my husband says it's the air inside the jar expanding and that's what's pushing the lid off. Who's right?
So I think that you're entirely right that the lid expands in the heat. The metal lid will expand much quicker than the glass jar that you've got. So that will expand and open up, and then you can loosen it up. It also has a lower specific heat capacity. So when it gets to a certain temperature, that expansion happens quicker than the glass that it's surrounded by. Okay, so as you increase the temperature of the gas will expand. It's incredibly unlikely to break that seal. But that's actually why on the top of kind of pasta sauce, when you buy it, it's popped up. And that's because they seal it when it's really, really hot. It's popped down. Yeah. And so they seal it when it's really, really hot. And then when it cools down, when it's on the aisle or whatever, that gas starts to sink down and get smaller again. So the lid pops down. And then you know that you've opened it when it pops up because it's got up.
It does say if you cannot depress this lid, you know, you know it's fresh.
I don't buy an awful lot of pasta sauce.
Because you would think if the jar air was made hotter, it would then force the lid up and that would actually make it harder to untwist the lid, wouldn't it? If the gas is pushing on the lid and making more friction between the lid and
I guess it would make it harder and harder to untwist. But what we're having the question, I think, is that the gas would expand so much it would just cause it to pop off without any untwisting at all. You had an interesting theory, right, about using a fork and whacking it?
Public service announcement. If you take a large knife and you invert it so it's the blunt edge of the knife, and then you just give a swift whack to the edge of a metal lid, it works almost every time. It's perfect.
That is the Kate Feller
guide. No
muss,
no fuss.
For how you actually managed to get your lid off your jar. Well, that's it. Thank you very much, everyone. We have run out of time. A huge thank you to our wonderful panel this week. That was Jess Wade, Andrew Holding, Richard Hollingham and Kate Feller. And thank you also to Paul Harris. Katie Haler put the programme together, and do join us next week for a very special show when we launch a new strand on The Naked Scientists. That's Naked Paleontology. Georgia Mills will be going back to the dawn of life to ask how it got started. The Naked Scientists comes to you from Cambridge University and is supported by the STFC, the EPSRC and Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith, and thank you very much for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.